You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, late in his presidency, Barack Obama develops some sympathy for whistleblowers. My guests Daniela Peled and Robin Lustig will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Israel taking a tough line on illegal settlements, though not in the fashion many would prefer. The European newspapers' somewhat equivocal reviews of Theresa May's Brexit speech, and a gleam of hope for our rancorous world as decades of acrimony over the correct signage on Japanese toilets are brought to a peaceful close. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and Robin Lustig, journalist and broadcaster and author of Is Anything Happening? My Life as a Newsman in All Good Stores Presently. Welcome both. And we will begin with President Barack Obama's startling act of outgoing clemency for Chelsea Manning, the American soldier convicted for the 2010 leak of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. Manning was sentenced to 35 years in 2013, but Obama has commuted the sentence. Manning will now be released in May. It was one of 209 commutations and 64 pardons that Obama signed as he prepared to leave the White House. Robin, first of all, how surprising is this? Barack Obama has not hitherto been characterized by much sympathy for whistleblowers.
That is absolutely right. I was surprised. I was pleased. I think the sentence that was passed on Chelsea Manning was disproportionate. I think it was right that she should have faced some penalty because she plainly broke the law. I do think, however, that she acted in the public interest. I think that the information that she revealed was for the public good. I think President Obama, literally in the dying days of his administration, has done the right thing. I'm pleased, but yes, I was surprised.
Daniela, do you think it is as simple as that, that Obama just thought that Manning had probably been punished enough, that 7 years will do and 35 was probably a bit much?
Well, it clearly was a bit much. If you look at the details, though, of her sentencing, she was eligible for parole after 8 years of a sentence. So I don't think anyone really expected her to serve the full amount. No, I agree with Robin. She did something wrong. She said she did something wrong. She had a trial, due process, and the sentence was so enormous. So I have sympathy for her. I have much more sympathy for her than I do for people such as Julian Assange, who apparently said that he was willing to be extradited to America.
This is the amusing subplot. Yeah. Yes, a few days before, Assange said he would be willing to be extradited to the US, although we should note that the US has not at all sought his extradition, if clemency was granted to Manning. Altogether unsurprisingly, he appears to be equivocating.
Yeah, so that would have been quite good. It was something that would have got him out of the Ecuadorian embassy. So all my sympathy for him is gone, but I feel quite pleased for Chelsea.
Robin, there have been those who have objected to this manoeuvre. Inevitably, a lot of it has been from the sort of swivel-eyed foam fleck tendency you would expect to object. But Senator John McCain, whose expertise in this field probably should be acknowledged, called the decision, I quote, "a grave mistake that I fear will encourage further acts of espionage." Is he wrong?
I think probably he is wrong, because when somebody makes a decision such as the one that Chelsea Manning took, they know it's a serious thing that they're doing, and they have weighed up the consequences. I confess I have some misgivings about the idea of an outgoing head of state being able to wave a magic wand and undo judicial decisions. I remember when Bill Clinton left office at the end of his second term, he also made some pardons, which were hugely controversial at the time. It seems a little odd in a nation which prides itself on the separation of powers, that
a nation of laws, not men,
all of a sudden, literally at the fag end of a administration, a head of state is able just to say, "Oh well, forget that conviction, you can go free."
Daniela, do intelligence services have to... I think Chelsea Manning has been punished because there is still that reflexive response among the intelligence community that any breach of classified protocols is a desperately serious crime verging on treason, if not actually being treason. But do intelligence services now need to reconcile themselves to the fact that it's very, very hard now to keep anything secret for terribly long once a certain number of people know it?
Yeah, I mean, this has also changed journalism as we know it in terms of journalists phone hacking or doing other unethical means of getting information, because there's plenty of hackers who are just willing and ready and able to do it for free and trying to take any opportunity to do it. And that's one of the issues with data leaks, is that it's leaked en masse with no responsibility. And there were all kinds of claims that Chelsea Manning's, the data that she leaked, led to all kinds of disasters. But this, the intelligence services are open to this, especially if you're talking about gigantic, vast amounts of data, which is what is collected now. It's metadata. It's not somebody meeting their contact on a park bench in Kiev. We're talking about large sums of data which have to be stored somewhere, then analysed and then sort of stashed away. So in that context, it's just not safe.
What is very difficult, I think, for intelligence services is that they now have to live in the knowledge that if there is somebody in the chain of information distribution who is unhappy with the way in which information is being collected or the use to which it's being put, it is now quite feasible that they will leak that information. In the past, if you were working in the security business, you either did what you were told or you got out. And even after you got out, you never said a word about it. That was the sort of agreement, the unspoken agreement. That's gone. People now have the right, or believe themselves to have the right at least, to say when they think something improper is being done. And when they say it, of course, the media will pick it up and run with it.
Just a final thought on this one, Daniela. There's inevitably, that is, been a bit of chat from some quarters that Edward Snowden should also have been pardoned. He is, of course, a different case in that he has not yet stood trial. Is that a crucial difference? Should Snowden not be pardoned, or at least considered for pardon, until he has faced trial?
Well, he also legged it to Russia, so that makes it quite a different kettle of fish from Chelsea Manning, who went through due process and a trial and got a very harsh sentence. But I think it was clear from the beginning that there was, in terms of how the parole was set, there was going to be leeway for her to be pardoned early. I think Edward Snowden, through his actions and through basically going to a de facto enemy state, has made it much, much more difficult for there to be any way back for him.
Okay, well, let's look now at Israel, where two people have been killed in clashes between police and Bedouin villagers over the demolition of illegally built homes. One of the dead was an Israeli police officer run over by a car. The other was the Israeli Arab driver of the car, who was shot dead. Opinion now splits along predictable lines over whether the driver was shot by police after he deliberately killed their comrade, or whether he lost control of the vehicle after being shot by police. Daniela, what do we understand of what actually happened?
Well, I watched the police video of the event. It seems clear to me from a cursory scanning of it that you see a car proceeding down the road. Three policemen approach it. Shots are fired. Car speeds up, seems to go out of control, rolls down the hill and runs several people over. So that seems to be on first viewing, it seems to be to indicate that this wasn't an act of terror. But of course, it didn't prevent certain irresponsible sections of the Israeli media for announcing that it was an act of an ISIS terror, because it comes very close after the killing of four Israeli soldiers in Jerusalem when somebody drove a vehicle into them. So irresponsible reporting doesn't really help. Also, there were several members, Palestinian citizens of Israel, members of Knesset, including the leader of the joint list, Ayman Odeh, he was injured with rubber tip bullets. But then again, the reaction, I think, of the Israeli media, certain sections, and the Israeli government were saying the members of Knesset were there to incite tensions. They shouldn't have been there. Lines are being drawn over this, and it's It's an extremely unsavoury sight, especially when it seems that the demolition was ordered has something to do in connection with the Amona illegal settlement. So the settlers, the Jewish settlers in the West Bank, are saying, if you're going to demolish our illegal settlement, we want to see parity, and you should demolish some supposedly illegal buildings within Israel too.
We'll come back to that, Robin, on the reporting of it. And this is it's an extreme example of a dynamic that we've seen following terror attacks or things that might have been terror attacks all over the world in recent years. What drives this insistence by some parts of the media to leap to a conclusion, and to the most extreme, most negative, most terrifying conclusion to which they possibly can? In this particular case, it's the far from proven suggestion that the driver of the car was active in an outfit called the Islamic Movement.
The short and rather brutal answer, which every journalist, I think, has to acknowledge, is that fear sells. Mm-hmm. If you terrify your readers, your listeners, your viewers, they will stay with you because they're frightened. I think whenever there is an incident of this kind, there is an immediate wish to label it. Was it an act of terror or wasn't it? Was it an accident or wasn't it? Now, very often, that is not a question that can be answered instantly. There are confused reports of what happened. It takes time to investigate the sequence of events. I really worry that in this age of social media, in which not only, quote, professional journalists, unquote, but anyone can put out their version of events. And when you look at it on your mobile phone or on your tablet, it looks the same, whether it comes from a respectable media organisation or from Joe Public. And that means that it is very easy for people with axes to grind, with particular points of view that they wish to disseminate, to get their version out before the facts are known. And I think it's dangerous.
This is a dynamic we see often when there's a breaking story. You see the first people popping up on social media saying, why aren't the BBC reporting this? Yeah. To which the obvious answer is they're trying to figure out what actually happened before
exactly.
they report it.
Exactly.
But by the time they do that, everybody's lost interest in what actually happened.
You see, I mean, you know, when I were a young lad and I was starting out in journalism, you were taught to check everything. Check.
That's very, very 20th century thinking, Robin.
It was almost 19th century in my case. But yeah, and I mean, I do regret that that has gone away. And I think that people need to be aware that there is a difference between what reputable media organizations say and what is said on Twitter or Facebook or whatever else it might be. There is a difference.
I think also when you have an audience that this polarized, they can see the evidence of their own eyes and it still doesn't change their point of view. In Israel, there was the recent case of Elor Azaria, who was a soldier who shot to death a wounded Palestinian assailant. And it was captured on video. It was there, clear to see that the wounded man posed no imminent danger. There was no threat. Other soldiers were walking around. And yet he still continued to argue that he was afraid for his life, and people bought it because that's what they wanted to believe was the case.
But this is, the Middle East is a special case in this regard, and you would know this better than I would, but I've been on the receiving end of it, that you write a thing about the Middle East and you get angry emails from people who've read the same 500 words or whatever. Roughly half of them will accuse you of being a crazed Zionist fundamentalist who wants to annex Judea and Samaria to Israel, and the other half will accuse you of being a fellow traveller of Hamas, and they've all read exactly the same piece.
Indeed, I think there's an actual academic term for it, confirmation bias.
Yeah,
it's so very big in the Middle East.
Can I just say, Andrew, that the fact that this involves a Bedouin community makes it doubly difficult, because the Bedouin are doubly marginalised in Israel. They are non-Jews, they are Arabs, but they are not mainstream Arabs, if I can put it this way. They are a small community originally of nomadic people who didn't have settled homes, mainly living in the desert. They are by and large regarded by majority Israelis as loyal Israelis. They serve, for example, in the Israeli
Indeed.
Army. Some of the best army spotters and trackers are Bedouin. And the fact that they are now suspect in the way in which this incident would seem to suggest, I think is doubly sad, because they are, as I say, a doubly marginalised community.
To return to this incident, Daniela, this is the town concerned is Umm al-Hiran, which has been long contested. What is the Bedouin claim to it? They've taken this to the Israeli courts and they have lost. But what is the basis of their claim?
I mean, that there are wide issues here, and that many nomadic groups, and not just in Israel, have claim from customary law to their lands and say, we have been living here. And I understand that that this particular group of people may have been moved there 60 or so years ago. So there are no title deeds. There are no, you know, there isn't a paper trail. But I think what is particularly galling is that Israel wants people to move to the Negev Desert. It's, you know, a huge expanse of its territory. But it seems to want want Jewish people to move there. So there's all kinds of investment in Jewish towns, settlements, and so on. But when Bedouin want to land and want their village to be recognised, it's a different matter altogether. And it's extremely difficult for Bedouins to construct homes legally. So you have this backwards and forwards, this merry-go-round of they build homes and build buildings without authorisation, and which comes in and gets knocked down. And this particular spike of violence is, as Robin says, particularly worrying, because the further you're driven as a minority group away from the state, if you are invested in the country, if you serve in the military and so on, and you feel excluded from it, there's very, very worrying social gaps that can emerge.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Daniela Peled and Robin Lustig. Coming up next, mixed reviews in continental newspapers for Theresa May's Brexit speech. Mixed, that is, between incredulity, irritation and derision.
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother, and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Peled and Robin Lustig. Now, if one is, just for fun, trying to think of something positive to say about yesterday's speech by British Prime Minister Theresa May, it might be acknowledged that she accurately channeled the views of roughly 52% of her electorate vis-a-vis Europe. Lofty, dismissive and apparently convinced that Britain is doing everyone a massive favour by deigning to exist a mere 26 miles across the water. She will have spent little of today carefully cutting out European newspaper reports of the speech for her scrapbook, however. Daniela, is Britain underestimating how incandescently annoyed everybody else is?
Well, some parts of Britain, perhaps, but I think that this is dawning on quite a few Brexiteers as well. I mean, the tone, you're right, in the media coverage from across Europe was, well, it was quite galling as well, because it was quite funny as well. They seem to have used sort of British, the British sense of humour across on the continent. But I think people, our European counterparts, are mightily annoyed, and they feel mightily abandoned and betrayed right now when Europeans and the UK face this growing uncertainty and threat perhaps from Russia, and who knows what's going to happen on the other side of the pond. And Britain is saying, all right, hands up, we're leaving you to it. We should be presenting a united front on a practical level. And it seems very hard to imagine how any of this will end well, and how, when Europe is so very cross with us, justifiably, they're going to come out with something, they're going to bring something reasonable to the table.
Robin, the headline in La Repubblica was possibly, indicative. London puts up its wall, or at least it said in Italian. Is that how Europe now sees the rest of the UK?
Yes, but even more hurtful for a proud Brit like me is that they're now laughing at us. They are regarding what Theresa May and the British government are saying and doing with derision. They think that the Brits are deluding themselves, that somehow they can sit around the table with the 27 other members of the European Union and all be nice palsy-walsy together and come up with a nice agreed deal. They can't. As Daniela says, they are furious with the UK for creating a major problem at a time when goodness knows there are enough other major problems to deal with. So they're not going to play nice about this. And the idea, which seems to be very widespread among those Brits who do want to leave the EU, that somehow it can all be done in a reasonable way. That's not how it seems in Europe. They are going to make it hurt. And the fact that Britain seems not yet to understand that that's the mindset, they think is just delusional. They cannot believe that Brits could be so stupid. They, you know, Britain had quite a good reputation for being the sensible country in Europe.
By and large.
Fair-minded, at least. Not anymore.
Daniela, in more recent developments, today's developments, how much do you think it's helping that we have seen Boris Johnson telling the EU not to treat the UK's Brexit escape like it was a World War II movie, and David Davis saying, we coped with World War II, we will cope with this?
That's exactly what they want to be making German analogies. Everyone's doing it.
To which you can only retort that World War II, in fairness, the Germans started that one, perhaps not so much this time.
Yeah, analogies really not a good idea to be made as well. I mean, what I don't get is, looking at the whole idea of Brexit charitably, I understand it was about sovereignty. It was about taking back sovereignty for Britain. I didn't realise, I suspected, but it wasn't about controlling and stopping immigration, and that being the altar on which everything else is sacrificed.
There's some very interesting numbers on that. On the day of the referendum, the pollster Michael Ashcroft did a very substantial exit poll. He asked 12,000 voters, as they came out of the polling stations, having voted in the referendum, why they voted the way they did. Only one third of those who voted leave said it was because of immigration. Now, what Theresa May has chosen to interpret the results of the referendum as a vote, an overwhelming vote, that Britain should now somehow control free movement of people.
That's always a difficult question for pollsters, because people do have that idea that in polite society you're not actually supposed to say you're against immigration.
I wonder if that's still the case. Maybe you're right. Okay. But nevertheless, what Theresa May is doing, she has chosen to interpret an extremely broad question. Do you wish Britain to remain in the EU? Do you wish Britain to leave the EU? In terms that she believes will do her the most good. What I fear is that she's making exactly the same mistake that David Cameron made when he launched the party on this referendum path. He is taking Britain down a very, very rocky path for reasons of party management. Theresa May thinks that what is now called in the British media a hard Brexit, in other words, leaving the single market, leaving the customs union, is the only thing that her party will put up with. Never mind what's in the best interests of the country. Let us remember, this is a prime minister who, until the day of the referendum, believed it would be in Britain's interests to stay in the European Union. She now seems committed to taking it as far out as she can, for reasons, as I say, I suspect, of party management.
Is it possible, Daniela, final thought on this, that there is some brilliant negotiating strategy underpinning this, that Theresa May is doing that Trumpian, if you will, thing of starting out from an extreme position and then hopefully coming in somewhat?
Interesting, because I don't know what she's left
See, I've lived in Britain now long enough to know what it means when a British person says interesting.
I don't quite know what she's left us to bargain with. She's already made the lines quite clear. No immigration, no this, no that, no everything. A Trumpian, I feared it may be Trumpian in a different way than perhaps you intended to say.
She's doing that poker sort of thing, isn't she? Oh, you've got no idea what hand I've got. Whoa, you just try and raise the stakes here and you'll see what I've got. Well, I don't think it's going to work.
I have in my time at least once that I recall gone all in on a pair of threes and hoped it would scare everybody else off. And
well, you'll understand Theresa May perfectly.
I hope it works out better for her than it did for me. finally tonight, and at the very real risk of lowering the tone, the 9 member companies of the Japan Sanitary Equipment Industry Association have announced a reform as vital as it is overdue, declaring that henceforth they will all use the same 8 instructional pictograms on their fancy electronic toilets. Let joy be unconfined. Daniela, should this be a cue for sort of ecstatic crowds gathering in the squares of Japan, fireworks displays and flypasts?
Well, one imagines if there is a, depends on what the pictograms are, perhaps if there's a spin cycle as opposed to sort of a gentle fan heating. I wonder if this is perhaps...
I would be riveted by the minutes of the meetings.
Well, quite. I wonder if this is perhaps aimed at growing the export market for Japanese-style tile toilets, although I find it hard to imagine that they would be palatable for most Europeans or Americans.
It's a long overdue reform, in my view. I mean, I confess that using toilets in Japan has been one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. And
it is bracing.
You're just terrified of pressing the wrong button. I mean, the last thing you want to do is to be ejected from a toilet in Japan. But this whole thing about
the ejector seats are fairly deluxe accoutrement.
Well, maybe. But I love signs. I mean, I love looking at signs and I love the way in which they are designed. As somebody who spent a lot of time travelling on the London Underground, and the carriages there, as you know, are festooned with signs, do not do this, don't do that, don't stand near the doors, don't sit here because if you're not pregnant, and all the rest of it. And somebody has had the great idea of coming up with fake signs which look as if they're real and very well might be. Can I just give you a couple
Please
of ideas?
Do.
One of them, which I like particularly, I mean, anybody who's travelled in London will understand this one, no eye contact, penalty £200. I mean, that works very well. And of course, it is obeyed by everybody. The other one I like, because again, it's got that ring of truth. Naughty passengers will be crushed.
My favourite act of vandalism, I think, was in a London Underground carriage. It was one of those old signs that they used to have on the inside of the doors that said obstructing the doors can cause delay and be dangerous. Somebody had painstakingly scratched out the letters and right bits of letters so it read obstruct the doors, cause delay and be dangerous.
Anarchism lives.
I think that's what everybody I knew spent their teenage years doing in the 1980s.
To return to the subject at hand, Daniela, are they possibly overthinking this, do we think?
Well, think about...
Or is it arguable that the Japanese have been overthinking bathrooms all along? I share Robin's confusion. I remember once checking into the Western Hotel, I think, in Osaka, and sort of wanting to take a shower at the end of a long flight and being confronted with something that looked like the control deck of the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah, I think they seem to operate on the theory that more is more when it comes to technology. But, you know, coming from a humble European background, whereas a toilet is just, you know...
Fairly straightforward, normally.
Yes.
Fairly straightforward.
Not even requiring any instructions.
No.
Are there any realms, Robin, in which you would like to have seen the signage simplified? Have you experienced any significant mishaps in this
regard?
Well,
I can certainly think of an occasion when any sign at all would have been useful. Many years ago, I was staying in a private home in Kenya, and I wanted to turn on the light switch in the bedroom, which I had been allocated, and I went in through the door, and I pressed the switch on the wall next to the door, and this huge siren started. And I discovered that... Even though this was long after the independence of Kenya, they had never bothered to deactivate the anti-Mau Mau alarm. A sign there would have been quite useful.
Dare we ask what ideas you've had for the sign that might have been appropriate?
Well, something like, don't hit this switch.
Yeah, it's not so much a signage issue, but a packaging issue. But I do remember once feeling... harbouring feelings of non-affection towards who I may have had one or two drinks the night before. Whoever it was who thought it was a brilliant idea to put shaving foam in a tube exactly the same size and shape as toothpaste. I remember,
grow a beard like some of us,
I remember Andrew, thinking one morning I wanted to catch up with that person and have a word with them. On that note of misapprehension, Daniela Peled and Robin Lustig, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Geriat. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.